Hi, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. If you didn't pick up a survey form that's on the podium by the door, you can pick one up on your way out, or you can sign up for to get an electronic one to give feedback on the presentation for our events statistics. So welcome to our spring lecture for the Library Environment Committee. It is my pleasure today to introduce Nathan Poirier. Nate is a graduate student in sociology and in the Women's and Gender Studies and Animal Studies specialization. He earned a master's degree, a Master of Science degree from Canisius College, where his research investigated in vitro meat, which is also the topic of his presentation today. Nate has a background in math, followed by following his bachelor's study at Aquinas College with an MA in mathematics from Western Michigan. Nathan's work in the PhD program in sociology is also interdisciplinary, bringing together social movement theory, critical pedagogy, anarchist theory, and intersectional theory to think about the urgent environmental issues of our time, including the role of animals, resource consumption, and population in the challenge in the challenges ahead of us. Please welcome Nathan Poirier.
Okay, so thank you. Thank you, Scott, for the introduction. And thank you all for coming today. And I also want to thank the Library Environmental Committee for organizing this this talk and this opportunity. So my master's, second master's thesis was on in vitro meat kind of in general. And since then I have been able to publish parts of that, but I haven't had the opportunity to speak on it. So this is the first time I get to speak and maybe discuss at the end here this topic. So I'm really excited and grateful for this opportunity. So some general words on this presentation. This is going to be kind of essentially an overview of the academic peer-reviewed literature on IVM, in vitro meat, IVM for short, concerning the environment. So I'm going to narrow the focus to the environment for this talk. So if this were to be turned into a paper, which I'm sort of working on doing as well, it would kind of be a review essay. So that's kind of the general outlook for this. And then lastly, at the beginning, I do want to mention, because I think it's important with this topic, but I myself identify as what we might call a vegan. I do not eat animal products, although the term I'm becoming more and more iffy with, the term vegan itself, but I do not eat animals. And so in vitro meat is emerging in response to animal agriculture, which we'll discuss a little bit, but also as some sort of kind of alternative to even veganism. So it really straddles the two. And so the issue of vegetarianism, veganism also comes into play, not so much today, but I think it's worth kind of noting that ahead of time. It's certainly a potential source for bias, which I freely admit. And that way, if you're aware of that, you can perhaps more objectively sort out some of this information for yourself. So let's go ahead and get started and look at IVM and the environment. So first, we'll kind of start with this idea or the concept of sustainability. And so if you do some research into sustainability, you read papers on it in its various contexts, you might notice that a lot of definitions of sustainability are quite vague and subjective. It's a concept a lot of us might think we understand. We'd know it if we saw it or we heard it. But if we actually try to define it and pin it down, it turns out to be rather complicated. And so one example to start with is kind of the definition of sustainability coming from the Brundtland Report. The report was called Our Common Future. It was a United Nations report from 1987 on sustainable development. And so this is the quote of how they define sustainable development in their report. And so they link it with development. And so development that meets the needs of the present without compromising future generations meeting their own needs. All right, so this is I think it's a rather famous definition of sustainability. It's pointed to a lot. But it's also an example of a very vague definition. First of all, the writers of this report in this study link development with sustainability, which I think itself can certainly be questioned. But even ignoring that and moving on to the rest of this, meeting the needs of the present, right? What does that mean? What needs? How do we know those needs are met? And who's receiving them? None of those seem to be answered. And so then to do that without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs, well, the same sort of questions arise. What future generations? How far into the future? What are their needs going to be? And how can we even tell if we can know those? All right, so there's lots of issues with this concept of sustainability, but we use it a lot as if we really know what we're talking about. Maybe, maybe not. Okay, so here is a table from a study, so not my own, where the authors did a review of sustainability literature and tried to kind of come up with a typology of sustainability. And so they come up with three sections here, the dominant paradigm and then thin and thick versions of sustainability. And so the summaries of these types, of these categories, are on the bottom. I'm not going to go through the actual table itself. It's there for additional details. But so the dominant paradigm, in general, what tends to lead social relations, at least on a perhaps global scale within capitalism, is that there's basically no restraints. Right? There's no restraints to growth, to development, to trade. Basically, humanity has this viewpoint under the dominant paradigm of we can use the earth how we want, and if any problems arise, we'll simply solve it with technology, no big deal. So that's the dominant paradigm. So then if we move to thin versions of sustainability, we start getting the notion of some protection here, some restraint. Thin versions of sustainability tend to try to come up with win-win scenarios. And so this is where you often get the notion of sustainable development. Right? We can have development, we can have growth, but we can do it in a way that doesn't apparently compromise future needs, so we can keep doing it like this. And so you get a lot of the language of management, managing natural resources under this thin conception of sustainability. And there's also a focus in the thin version of efficiency per capita. So how can certain units of analysis, perhaps, most efficiently use a particular resource at a given time? But it doesn't address overall use. And so the thick versions of sustainability are a little bit more, I suppose, inclusive of the natural world. Thick versions of sustainability look at nature largely as something to perhaps be left alone, not necessarily managed, and not necessarily messed with, used. So the thin and the thick versions can kind of be analogous to the classic debate that still continues over our national parks. Gifford Pinchot against John Muir. And so Gifford Pinchot was a big champion of what we might now call the thin version of sustainability. We need to manage these parks. We can extract the resources, but do it carefully. Whereas John Muir said we basically need to leave this alone, let it be. It handles itself perfectly. So that's kind of what the thick version of sustainability is and what these authors came up with as a general overview. So again, I want to revisit this question of sustainable for whom? And when we talk about sustainability, who are we talking about? What are we talking about? Who reaps the benefits? And so environmentalism in general deals on the ecosystem or species level. And so what that means is it deals with groups, not necessarily individuals. But to individuals, sustaining their own life or their quality of life is also pretty important. So, you know, who gets left behind and why? There's a lot of value judgments that come into this. And so our social relationships in the human and in the animal world, okay, are plural and hierarchical. We have many of them and they're related. They're somehow overlapping. And in particular, we might be able to call these nested communities, because if we think of our relationships as starting perhaps with ourselves, and then we're connected to those most closely related to us, our immediate family. Right? And then our family, we may be spread out, but we're based in some sort of community, either surrounding members, surrounding institutions. And then we can get outside of that. Our family, you know, it doesn't have to be all located, but could be located within one particular nation, or we might identify with a nation and care about that, and work our way out from there. right, to perhaps encompassing the whole world. And so a lot of ethics theories are based off this sort of idea, too, of nested communities and our ties to various groups and groupings. And so who do we care about? Who's in our moral concern? And so we get this term, the overlapping spheres of moral concern, from Callicott, an environmental ethicist. But it works for sustainability, too. Right? How far out are we willing to look in our nested communities to sustain resources for everyone? How do we define everyone who gets them in terms of all these relationships? So in light of these sorts of problems with sustainability, using it in an absolute sense, saying something is sustainable versus not sustainable, might not be the best way to go. Perhaps we should change our language a little bit and use terms like relative or optimal sustainability. Right? So relative sustainability, some choice being more sustainable relative to some particular alternative, or optimal sustainability. Maybe we can't achieve true sustainability, but we can come up with an optimal situation given the circumstances we're in. Or else perhaps conceive of sustainability as an aspiration. So again, sustainability might be constructed as this absolute goal and ideal, but realizing we'll never quite make there, but we can make it, but we can see kind of how far we can go. So with those issues in mind, we can then talk about the unsustainability of animal agriculture. And this is certainly an important part because in vitro meat is emerging as a direct reaction to the unsustainability of animal agriculture. So first here, we just have a qualitative overview of the problems that animal culture, agriculture causes. In the first bolded sentence, what follows that is a lot of human-related issues, which I think are also important, but not our focus today. So it's included in the same quote, so I kept it. But the second bolded part, so animal agriculture may now be the single greatest source of, and here's the environmental problems listed, so fresh water use and pollution. So animal agriculture uses a lot of fresh water, and that is becoming exceedingly scarce around the globe. That's a major problem. In general pollution, environmental pollution. Animal agriculture is the leading source, or the leading cause of rainforest deforestation. It's the driving force behind the species extinction, so it plays a major, major role in biodiversity problems. And this says among the largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions, but animal agriculture has been, I believe, the largest source for quite some time now, since at least the 2006 report, Livestock's Long Shadow, when they determined that at a relatively low percentage, but that percentage may even be much higher. So animal agriculture is a big, big issue for many of our big, big problems. So some quantitative aspects of that. I'm not going to go through these point by point. They just kind of back up the qualitative quote on the previous slide. What I do maybe want to mention, though, is the quotes in the middle that are bolded that have to do with fish, because we run into this issue of relative sustainability when you start getting at people's sort of core and natural behaviors, which for most people is to eat animals. And so we tend to want to defend ourselves and move to perhaps relatively sustainable practices like fish. That's a big thing. People will give up, traditional meat, farm animals, but go to fish. But there's huge sustainability problems with that. And so right now we have that 2/3 of all managed oceanic fish stocks are already overexploited or depleted. And these are the managed stocks. This is what's happening under that thin version of sustainability, right? We'll harvest in quotas that we can replace. Well, that's clearly not working. And so under these current fishing patterns, which we've already depleted 2/3 of the fish stocks that we want to eat, scientists are predicting the global collapse of all currently fished taxa by 2050. And that's coming up pretty quick. And these are two separate studies with these two separate conclusions. But if 2/3 of what we're managing is already failing, then the prediction by 2050 doesn't seem so far-fetched. So then humane alternatives, right? So if the farm animals don't work, if the fish don't work, then again, we might try to smooth over our relative sustainability by coming up with further alternatives. Again, I don't want to go through this point by point, but the point here is that there is a problem with every sort of humane alternative. There's an environmental problem. Grass-fed cows at least they produce more greenhouse gases. They use more energy than intensively raised cows. Free range is the biggest one, or my favorite one of these, I suppose, because free range is a physical impossibility. Based on how many animals we eat now and the amount of space animals need to live at all sustainably, here the estimate is 15 acres per animal, just counting for cows and pigs in the United States. We have, 2.5 billion acres of land is needed, but the U.S. only has 2.3 billion acres land, and that's in its complete totality, including where the cities are, mountain ranges, deserts, which cannot be suitable for animal agriculture. So that does not include the turkey, sheep, and chicken still, right? So the free range just isn't going to work. And then local, there's problems with greenhouse gases. So if you eat local but if you eat non-local but plant-based, then you're actually still helping the environment more than if you eat local but animals. And then fish farms. I started factory farming fish because the oceans aren't working out so well for us. But fish farms have big problems too. Fish need to eat fish. We still need to capture wild fish to feed these captive ones. And we take in a lot more than we get out from those. So there are issues with these. So with these problems of sustainability and these problems with animal agriculture, is in vitro meat going to be the answer? So what is in vitro meat, or IVM? So the short of it is in vitro meat is meat grown from the cells of an animal without killing the animal. Okay, so here is a visual of the process, so we can kind of understand what's involved, and this is kind of important for evaluating it. So this is one scheme, but they're all pretty similar like this. So we'll first by taking a small biopsy, and this is kind of an unusual picture because it says small biopsy, but that's a rather large chunk if this were to be to scale here. But the biopsies can be very, very small, size of a quarter or a dime or something like that. And in fact, they don't even have to extract muscle, actual muscle. We could just extract cells. Even better. And so step two there is extracting the cells. And so the satellite cells, and those are muscle stem cells. So cells that we can induce to become muscle. And so once we have those cells, we put them in some sort of growth serum. We give them nutrients, essentially, so that they grow just like normal cells do. They take in nutrients from the blood and such, and divide and grow. And so these cells will do that naturally as long as they have a nutrient source. So we let them do that, and then we attach these cells to like a scaffold mechanism, something where they can build and grow on. So we create these sort of, not like I'm involved in this, but so they create thin sheets of muscle as cells sort of eat their way up these scaffolds. Along the way, though, these thin sheets of muscle then have to be exercised, or in the lower left there, and that's to induce and to boost the protein content of muscles, because that's kind of, part of what we eat meat for, right, the protein. But so once you have that, you have this formed piece of muscle that you can then grind up, and grind up is at least what's probably going to happen first. If you want a steak, you may or may not grind the food up, but simply stack things, but that's apparently quite a bit harder. But you can grind up the muscle strips that you make and then add whatever you might want to add, or whatever companies think they should add. And things have to be added to this. In vitro meat does not contain any iron, because iron comes from blood, and there wouldn't be any blood in cells. It also does not contain vitamin B12, which is necessary. Vitamin B12 comes from our guts. It's a bacteria created by our guts. There's none of that in IVM. So certain things will certainly have to be added, and towards the end of the process, they can be. And then finally, we can shape that mass that we have into whatever sort of form of meat that we want, and then there's our product. All right, so if we have IVM, then what is it good for, right? In terms of the environment, how good is this? Well, there's actually many reasons, and these span most of them, or most of the perhaps major ones. But first is that the IVM production systems themselves can be stacked vertically. So actually, if I go back really quick, the upper right and the lower left problems where pictures where the meat's growing up the scaffolds, that part has to be housed within a bioreactor. So that's basically just a housing mechanism for IVM. It controls the environment lets them grow in these cylinder containers. But they're the biggest part of the process. They take the most space, but those can be stacked vertically. They're just cylinders. There's no reason we couldn't stack those vertically. And so we don't need big expansive farms or anything like that for IVM. And so what that'll do is it'll certainly cut down on things like deforestation, right? We wouldn't need to expand current operations, so we wouldn't be needing to continue to cut down the forests for this. Also, partly from the vertical, being able to stack vertically, but IVM can be built near metropolitan areas where the meat demand is a lot larger, more people and whatnot. And so, again, we don't need to be located out away from places, which will, one, cut down on transportation costs. There doesn't have to be long-distance shipping. But it will also free up, potentially, a lot of wild land, what we think of as wild land, wilderness, whatever. And so this can let the wild animals perhaps do their thing, right? Behave a lot more naturally, roam over their ranges. Studies consistently show that if you just let struggling animal populations live, that they will recover. They can handle themselves, right? They've done it for a very, very long time. So if we can do this and free up this land, then a lot of the extinction problems that are happening could be helped a lot. So now use cells from endangered or extinct species. So with IVM, we could take cells from animals that are struggling on the endangered species list and culture meat from them. The method that we just looked at is essentially invariant with species, so it'd be just as easy to culture cow as it would be to culture auroch, which is where the cow came from, his ancient ancestor in the United States and Europe, which is now extinct. But as long as we had a cell sample, and I'm not sure all the species we may have cell samples from, but as long as we have a cell sample that's viable, we could do that. And so we could mitigate the threat on a lot of already struggling wildlife populations by, instead of needing to hunt them for meat, we can grow their meat and be able to give it to people. The resource use is also much more efficient. So when you use resources for IVM, all of it goes 100% into making muscle. None of the resource use is wasted on creating bone, on respiratory, the respiratory system, on animal movement, heat regulation. You know, all of it goes into exactly the product we want. And so largely because of that, on the bottom here, we have some quantitative goals, I guess, or predictions of what IVM can do. So reducing energy use by 7 to 45%, perhaps the most variable and the weakest, but still quite a bit, perhaps. Land use by 99%. Because we don't need these farms, we don't need these plant crops to then feed the animals. Water use and greenhouse gas emissions, so both approximately 80 to 96%. Right? And so these are huge numbers, these are huge benefits. These are the kinds of things we need to see to do the type of turnaround for the earth that we need, right, in terms of the environment. So these are major, these things are pretty major. However, there's problems with all of them. And so one of the first studies to really look at this was by, not sure how to pronounce the first name there, but Tromisto and Teixeira de Mato, so in 2011. And this is a study that's still very frequently cited in the IVM literature. It's where those high numbers, high percentages came from that we just saw. But there's a number of problems with this study. And so first of all, it only focuses on the production chain. So from cultivating cyanobacteria, that's what they use for their growth serum in this study, to the finished IVM product, but in the lab. So what that means is it ignores transportation. It's not factored into the study. Cyanobacteria is also possible, but it is not what's used in current IVM production, which does exist a little bit. But they're not using cyanobacteria. They're using an animal culture. Derivative. Now, the authors, though, are aware that they stop short of transportation, and they do address this. And they say that actually, if we were to count transportation, IVM would look even better because there'd be much less transportation involved. We wouldn't be transporting animals to and from slaughterhouses, and we wouldn't be driving meat as far away because we could be located in the cities, right next to the consumer. And refrigeration needs similar sort of thing. Whatever need refrigeration would be a lot less than if we were refrigerating animal parts that have bone and other things in them that would take up space, take up extra energy. Now this study, so the very bottom here, the problem is though, all of this is entirely theoretical. Nothing in this study is actually what happens in IVM production. The authors hypothesized every step of the process. So even though they get huge, huge gains, we really don't know if that's going to happen. So the lead author and Roy did another study in 2012 where they assumed 100% of meat conversion from Europe, or the EU, 27 countries back then, converted to IVM and said, well, what happens if all of Europe converts? And they used a lot of the same assumptions from the 2011 paper, though, so the uncertainties are still there. But they get pretty similar numbers. So just these four results here. So the greenhouse gas without the L's in the U's, that's land use and land use change. So the greenhouse gas reduction, if there's no land use change in the land that's freed up, we still get 99%. That's pretty much what they found before. Now, greenhouse gas reduction with the land use change, 603% reduction. I'll try to come back to that shortly. And then water use, 94, and land use, pretty much 100%. They actually get 99.8, I think, but that's basically 100%. But again, we have problems with this study. One, it's based off a lot of assumptions we're not sure of from the previous study. 100% of meat production is assumed to be converted to IVM in Europe, and I think that's very unrealistic. There's a very strong attachment of people to meat, of humans to meat. To expect all of it to be converted, I don't think is practical. But the 603% change in land use, so for greenhouse gases, assumes that all of the land use change, all of this extra land that's not used for animal agriculture will be used for positive purposes, like growing biofuels or reforestation. And again, I think that's a major claim that's not necessarily realistic. Right, what will actually happen? We don't know, and the authors don't speculate. This is a big table of their results, which probably even more quickly. We're not going to look at all of it anyway. But they pretty much just repeat the same analysis. This is from the 2012 study, comparing cultured meat here per edible unit of traditional meat, per protein unit, and then per energy unit. So two-thirds of this table on the right is more or less repeated. The same sorts of results are on the left side. And so it was an interesting study, though, because they compared IVM to a whole bunch of other things. And so at the top of this list, we have a few plant-based crops. And then we have the meat sort of in the middle, and then other sorts of products here. And so we can compare the use of IVM to these other ways of doing things. And if we look perhaps just at something, what's good here? Maybe greenhouse gases. So cultured meat, per edible unit of cultured meat, cultured is another term for IVM, they also call it that. So the cultured meat, 1.9 of their units here for greenhouse gases per edible unit. But if we look at plant sources, the top four plant sources, they all have lower greenhouse gas footprints than IVM does. And if we move down the list, spirulina is lower, and that's kind of an outlier in this whole table compared to cultured meat. That's a bacteria. Again, and so those tend to be even more efficient. But if we look at the meats for greenhouse gases, these are in the tens, around 10 or even 30, much, much higher than cultured meat, so we see the relative benefit there. And then eggs, milk, and cheese, so the vegetarian products, 4, 1, and 8. Milk might be comparable to cultured meat, but eggs and cheese are certainly a lot higher greenhouse gases than cultured meat. So the IVM works better compared to some things, but not all things. And so in lieu of time, I'm going to end the table there and continue a little bit. So then this study came along in 2014. Again, the same lead author, two other co-authors. They tried to update the 2011 study using more accurate methods, more accurate predictions. And there's still lots of limitations with this study. They still conclude high uncertainty. But better measurements. And so if we look at the results, so the 2014 study by Tuomisto and colleagues, and the original 2011 study by Tuomisto and Teixeira de Matos, we see a little bit of a change. When all of a sudden things are measured more accurately, if we look at water use, say in 2014, so the other colors here are different types of animals, and red is IVM. All of a sudden, water use is much more comparable to other animals besides cows, whereas in the original study, we got it very, very low. So more accurate measurements make at least the water use aspect of IVM much less of a potential gain. Still better, perhaps, but much less. And then if we also focus on energy use in 2014 for IVM goes way up to even above beef, total energy use. Whereas in the 2011 study, energy use was comparable to sheep, pork, and poultry, way less than beef. But again, more accurately, we get a much worse scenario. Greenhouse gas and land use are relatively the same, but things certainly change. So I'll try to go through these last few slides pretty quick here. But now we finally get some more studies that were a little critical of these earlier studies. So Maddock and colleagues, they did their own projection of IVM, but mostly they were looking at the earlier Chuomisto and Teixeira de Mato study from 2011 and saying, well, wait a minute, look at all these things that could go wrong that the authors aren't calling out. There's no actual mechanism to base predictions on. There's no standardized way of doing IVM exactly. Everything is questionable from that first study. And the second bullet point is really important. The original study in 2011 assumed a smaller portion of the animal body carcass that was edible than is probably the case. And that study did so by probably about half. They assumed only half of the animal of a general animal body is edible than actually is compared to a lot of other estimates. And so if more of the animal is actually edible, then the relative negativity of animal agriculture would come down a little bit compared to IVM, which means the benefit of IVM would be quite a bit less relative to animal agriculture. All right, so there's some things that are a little bit skewed here. So I'm going to quickly pass on to Johnson. In 2016, he did a much more qualitative study, and so he focused on the fact that basically what IVM proponents are doing, Chuomisto and all the studies there and whatnot, is they're relying on things like potentiality, hype, promises. Right, there's a lot of this, here's what it can do, but it hasn't done anything yet. And so that's kind of a big deal here. Let's see, a focus on the last bullet point in this too. These IVM diagrams, like the one we looked at, they don't really signal sources of outside energy use very well or waste management very well. If we went all the way back to that diagram, we'd see that we do have vitamins and minerals being added, but where are they coming from? It doesn't show that. There's no arrows indicating waste anywhere in these diagrams. They just don't do that. It seems to be ignored, hiding the truth, perhaps, of how this, you know, IVM would actually be realized. So here's kind of the summary, the basic points. There are many potential, but huge benefits to IVM. So even though I do not eat animals and I would never eat IVM, it's not something to just be cast aside. You know, just because of my personal principles. If it can deliver, it's certainly needed. But what would really happen to the freed up land, right? What other sorts of factors are involved in that? We don't know. It's hard to tell. Traditional meat consumption is rising in China and India, of course, the most populous countries in the world. So how would that offset any benefits of IVM, which is largely happening in the West? And public acceptance is a major impediment. We need people to be able to want to consume this for it to deliver on its promises. And in a couple quotes showing the skeptability of science wedded with capitalism, as likely IVM would be. So I end with this quote here by Mark Post. He was the lead creator of the first in vitro hamburger that was tasted in London in 2013, fairly famous event. And so this is where my, you know, opinions sort of come from. But he says here that with respect to the environment, never with this cultured beef program are we going to be as efficient and as friendly to the environment or to animals, another important consideration perhaps, as a vegetarian or vegan diet. We will never achieve that level of efficiency. All right, so we saw that IVM is better for the environment in terms of some respects, but not all. And I think vegetarianism, veganism is the ultimate way to try to achieve the optimal form of sustainability given our environmental problems. All right. So, thank you.
So we have a little while for Q&A, but please use the mics. It is being recorded. And Nate, I'll let you take your own questions unless someone gets difficult.
Sure. That sounds good. All right. Yes.
So what is the status in terms of technological development of this cultured meat?
Right. So IVM, pieces of cultured meat exist. There's been several, I don't know exactly, maybe a couple dozen or so hamburgers made. IVM meatballs were created first in 2016 and tasted. But again, those only exist on an individual basis. You can count the individual meatballs that have been made, the individual hamburgers that have been made. There's been some attempts at in vitro, goose. With the idea of replacing foie gras, but these things exist on you know, very, very small numbers. Nothing, I don't think, even approaching a commercial status yet. So it exists. You know, the prototypes exist. There's been proof of concept, but it's proving apparently very difficult to get beyond that stage. It's been in that stage for several years. So the studies were entirely theoretical, but at least the technology we know does exist.
Thank you very much for your talk. I appreciated the bullet point about the cultural differences and technological adoption. And the author that you had a difficult time pronouncing, is that from the East, maybe Asia? And I guess my question is there any scholarship coming out of non-Western areas?
The one author, Chomisto, how I'm saying it, I believe they're from Europe. I didn't research these a lot of the authors too much, but all their research is based out of Europe, at least. And I believe they're European. I only know of one article from China, in 2016, that came out about in vitro meat, but largely there does not seem to be non-Western attention to this. The centers are Europe mostly, and some of the US, but that's pretty much it. So far, and that's very important. It's one of the things I think is in a paper one of my papers that's published or forthcoming. That's a huge silence in the IVM literature. Is what of these cultured associations the meat? How would these non-Western cultures deal? Think about it. Would they accept it? Or their relations to animals, agriculture, meat is different than ours, right? And what about those? But the literature doesn't speculate. So it is an important consideration, but it's totally left unaddressed. Yeah. Yes?
I may have a more detailed question, but do you know what is the yield capacity if you're doing in vitro lab cultures? For example, how much meat can you grow in a month, that type of number? And the other is, what type of investment are you kind of coming to? Like, okay, if technology is really required, then you're producing that much more energy and water to be able to produce whatever the amount is, the demand is. So is there any analysis of that sort? Thank you.
All right, so the first part of that, trying to pay attention, I got swept up in the second part. What was the first part again? Oh yeah, the yield. So that I'm not really sure about. I'm not sure that's really commented on. They usually tend to break it down, like in the studies I showed of some sort of comparison unit, so per edible unit, whatever that might be, per kilogram or per ton, whatever, ton of in vitro versus ton of animal meat, or something else like they did per protein unit, whatever. So ideally, though, you can create a batch of in vitro meat, at least, in in a matter of weeks, so perhaps less than a month. So you can create at least, they're saying, a sufficient size. I'm not sure exactly how big of a size that is, but in vitro meat can come to sellable quantity in a matter of weeks, whereas animals will take months, possibly years, depending on source, whatnot. So you can certainly create comparable amounts in a quicker time. What those amounts are exactly, I'm not sure. They don't seem to be saying. So the other investments in terms of, I don't know. Really, these are also pretty large unknowns that people just don't seem to be talking about, at least in the academic literature. And that's part of the problem. And that's a lot of what I try to do with my work on IVM is point out these shortcomings. What's presented is very much one-sided. It's very grandiose. And it is good. It is important. But there's just so much that is not presented. That's also important, or misrepresented, somehow skews things. And so we need to have considerations like that caution, that act as caution against this IVM, so we don't buy into it and have it not work. I think that would be a major problem as well. But the money is very expensive right now, and that's a big thing. And the first in vitro burger in 2013 cost, I think, $330,000. To make, and it was not, some huge half pound or anything like that. It was rather small, like a McDonald's patty or something. But the investments are huge, but they're working on trying to get that down. Ideally, they would like to get the cost down to something like fast food price, really, really cheap. I don't know how they're doing that. There's not much market research on it. But I don't have very good answers for your questions. But based off my experience, those aren't much discussed, honestly.
I'm going to try and make a comment that's a question, but you can just take what you want from it. So,
sure.
So I appreciated your list of other kinds of protein or energy. Particularly, I noticed that corn is up there, Q-U-O-R, and I also appreciated that your diagram of the process showed that the outcome is a sausage, right?
Yeah.
So one of the limits is, one of the reasons why we like meat is because it's fat, and it has all of these flavors,
mm-hmm.
and I think we, many of us who eat meat would happily eat a veggie burger rather than a regular burger, but there's no veggie burger that's gonna take the place of like a nice fatty steak or lamb chop or something like that. But of those sort of like meat substitute things, corn actually tastes a lot like chicken. It tastes pretty good. So if we're gonna do something that's like chopped up kinds of meat, mm-hmm. probably most of us would just go ahead and do a vegetable substitute rather
sure.
than a like super expensive sausage with meat product in it,
right?
Which also comes back. So this leads to this is actually going somewhere, which is sort of also this cultural appropriateness I was envisioning these bioreactors in different places, but I could only picture them in very urban situations, and that tells me that it's not appropriate for many of the kind of rural life ways that animal agriculturists around the world. So it might be better than, say, pig farms in North Carolina, less good for rural areas in Thailand or China. So this is the last point, and you're welcome to respond however you want to any of this, which is about the human-animal relationship in the sort of, your second to last slide brought back. We don't know if we stop using this land for animal agriculture, will we have urban sprawl? Will we have these other things? And so I'm thinking about, especially in the US West, the relation between public lands and cattle grazing and the kinds of partnerships that actually have arisen between environmentalists and cattle ranchers to keep wide open spaces so that we're not actually having encroachment of other kinds of development on those spaces. So lots for you to decide how you want to respond. Pretend there's a question.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, just more important things to consider, right? So many things that are part of this picture. I mean, meat is so widespread, it's so integral to so many people that there are a lot of relationships that would be disrupted if it were to go away. And we have to consider those. So even if my position is not to eat animals at all, which would have a similar effect to IVM, you can't just ignore the farmers, the people that do exist. I mean, they live, they're people, they matter too. So you have to, you know, respect their feelings, right? Respect them as individuals and their relationships. And I mean, what happens, you know, who knows? I don't know. That's certainly not speculated on either, anywhere, really. It's maybe brought up in some papers, but who knows what would happen. So a big sort of unknown. But the land conversion problem that you brought up too, you know, what would happen with it? The quote we have here in the second bullet point here, you know, when the time comes, there will be plenty of room for cities to spread themselves again. That's from Winston Churchill, actually, in 1931. But that's the kind of mentality that would easily take over. He actually not foretold, but theorized in vitro meat back in, I forget when, in the 50s maybe. But a long time ago, he totally nailed what IVM is now, conceptually. But, you know, IVM is emerging, so with a lot of things. We got traditional meat, we have vegetarianism, which is also really taking off right now, or veganism, but also population growth, global population growth. Which has continued to happen pretty much throughout human history. And one of the big concerns of IVM is to feed the growing population, with the population predictions in either 2050 or 2100, growing to 9, 10 billion people on Earth from our 7.5 right now. How do we feed them? Animal agriculture, the idea is, won't do it. It can't do it. It's just not sustainable, right? Well, it'll implode before it actually feeds the world. So IVM can do it. That's the claim. But If the population increases by a full 33% or so from what it is now, some of that freed land will certainly be taken over by people, and so some of the benefits from that land will certainly not be realized. So that's another thing that's happening, population growth that's happening against this IVM that enters into the analysis, or should, but it's not. Everyone assumes population growth, and these studies still assume land reduction of very significant proportions, but those two ideas don't really match up, and so that's a big issue, I think. Yeah, as part of it, and then you have the whole, you already have a whole sector of the marketplace that is fake meat, vegetarian, vegan meat replacements, whatever you want to call them. You have non-dairy milks taken off, and these things are really gaining acceptance. Not only do they exist in much larger quantities than IVM, but people are accepting them. Not everyone, but the markets for them are certainly growing, with a number of people saying diets for 2019, lifestyles for 2019, veganism is where it's at. And you have veganism growing in at least the West again, UK and the United States exponentially. So those are happening, right? And so that's a lot of my viewpoint, is if that's already happening, maybe we should just go with that instead of creating this whole system, which is very money intensive, tons of unknowns. Let's go with something that's sort of already working. So that's kind of my response.
Any last question?
We really do have time for one last question. All right, thank you. Thanks, Nate.